Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Movie Geeks United, the most popular movie talk radio show on the internet. Tonight, our biggest show yet. It's been warming the hearts of festival audiences across the country, from the remarkable family film Canvas, writer-director Joseph Greco, and one of our most beloved character actors, Joe Pantoliano. Plus, Adam Green, the writer and director of the most buzzed-about horror film of the year, Hatchet. And director Christy Jacobson will talk to the geeks about her upcoming documentary release, Toots. Now, dim the lights, grab the popcorn, and get ready to get your geek on. Here are your hosts for Movie Geeks United, Jamie, Chris, and Jerry.
Welcome to a very special 90-minute episode of Movie Geeks United on Blog Talk Radio. I am one of your co-hosts for the evening. My name is Jamie, and we have Jerry here as well. Hey, Jerry.
Hey, what's up?
And we have Chris here, too. Hey, Chris.
What's up, guys?
It's good to hear from both of you, and we're very excited. Very excited about this show tonight. Couple of notes. You can subscribe to Movie Geeks United through iTunes. It's absolutely free. Just click on the subscribe to iTunes icon on the right-hand side of your Blog Talk Radio screen. You'll be able to catch up on all the great shows. They'll automatically download into your iTunes system, and we've had some great shows lately, including our two-hour tributes to Al Pacino and Brian De Palma and David Lynch, and the one we recently did, our tribute to five character actors, including Stephen Tobolowsky, Jack Warden, Veronica Cartwright, Emmett Walsh, J.T. Walsh. Just some great programming for you to enjoy and listen to. Also, a great way to spread the word on these great films that we're featuring on tonight's show is to get your very own Movie Geeks United player for your website, your blog, your profile page. If you'd like your very own player, it'll automatically download the latest episodes of Movie Geeks United anytime your page is loaded, so you can share it with all of your visitors on the web. Just email us at moviegeeksunited@yahoo.com, and we will send you the code for that player. That's a great service, isn't it, guys?
Yes, it is. I love it.
Yeah. Great show for you guys tonight. If you want to call in, if you have any questions for our guest this evening, the number to call is 718-508-9477, or if you're too shy to speak on the radio, you can always email us at moviegeeksunited@yahoo.com. Got a very packed show tonight, so let's get right to it. What do you guys
think? Let's
go. All right. Canvas is the first feature film from writer-director Joseph Greco, and it tells the story of a family played by Joe Pantoliano, Marcia Gay Harden, and young Devin Gearhart, who struggle to maintain a sense of normalcy in the face of schizophrenia. The film has received critical raves from the likes of John Anderson and Variety, who praises the picture's first-rate performances and uncompromising point of view, and Frank Sheck from The Hollywood Reporter, who singles out the unusually sensitive approach to its subject. But let's get to the accolades that really count, the outpouring of praise from the thousands of audience members who have already witnessed the film in festivals across the country. To them, Canvas is more than a movie. It's something of a gift, and they have taken it into their hearts like no other film in recent memory. Tonight, we are honored to have the exceptionally talented writer-director of Canvas, Joseph Greco, and the film star and just one of the greatest actors on the planet, a tremendous treat for all of us, Mr. Joe Pantoliano. Joseph, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
And
hi, Joe.
Hey, Joey. Happy birthday, Joey.
Absolutely. Happy birthday.
Happy birthday.
Thank you very much.
We can't thank you both enough for joining us tonight. It's a great pleasure. I had the pleasure of seeing this movie earlier this year at the Sarasota Film Festival, and I have never seen an audience reaction like it. People were just so incredibly moved by this film, and they really took it into their hearts. And
yeah, well, enough about you. What do you think of me? That's an old joke. I had to use it.
You were remarkable, but we'll save that for a little bit later. Mr. Greco, I wanted to ask you first. This is your first feature film, and
that's
when
great.
you when you sat down to write this, it looks like you followed what they say is one of the first rules, you to write what you know.
Yeah, absolutely. And I was, you know, I set out to make this movie some time ago after graduating film school and actually worked as an assistant to James Cameron during Titanic, which is when I actually first started putting pen to paper.
Mm-hmm.
But it took a while to get off the ground, and I think that was actually a good thing, because that long gestation period, I think, gave me a lot of objectivity. But, you know, it's what's been really interesting and what's been great about working with Joey is that, you know, I tend to approach, you know, directing just from the standpoint of trying to create the most honest moments I can. And when you have great actors, you know, you're always getting great ideas. So the script was evolving even through production. Joey and I, you know, Joey, in addition to starring in the movie, is also a producer. So we did a lot of work before he came down to Florida to shoot the movie. And, you know, it was a really great collaboration. So I think, you know, and in fact, a couple of the best lines in the movie, I wish I could take credit for, but I can't. There's, you know, Joey, which, you know, so, but yeah, I mean, I appreciate what you guys are saying, and it's been really amazing, you know, the journey, just making this film, and now seeing the audiences really take to it is quite wonderful.
It is amazing, and it seems that everyone's responding to a real sense of truth and authenticity from the...
Yeah, yeah, and you know, the thing about, and Joey will talk about this, I'm sure, is, you know, he and Marcia both went out of their way to make sure that their portrayals were really on the mark,
uh-huh.
and they spent time with people in the mental health community doing their research, and the thing that I love, the thing that's most, one of the things that's most gratifying is that people, not just people in the mental health community, you know, not just the doctors, but, you know, critics are saying it's in their opinions the most accurate portrayal of schizophrenia that they've ever seen in movies, which is a testament to Marcia. I mean, she's just phenomenal, and there's no one else who could have pulled off the part.
Absolutely.
Thank you for that.
Mr. Pantoliano, was it that sense of truth and authenticity, was that one of the things that stuck out for you when you first read the script?
Actually, I've thought selfishly that it was a great opportunity for me to play a role where I was a caregiver and victimized, you know, by this illness. I see this movie more a movie about what happens to a family who has when mental illness is brought into the fold. You know, Joe's was born to a schizophrenic mom, and his whole life was that. And we thought, Joe and I and Marcia included, thought that it would be better for Mary's illness to come around age 4 or 5 years old, so that Christopher had a memory, the same memory that the father and the son shared in the memory of their mother being whole and the caregiver and making dinner and working, and so that when that element stopped, both he and I started to unravel in our own way. And then the saving grace in the movie, besides the help that she's able to get and the understanding, just like any kind of addiction, when she's willing to accept that there is something wrong, that she admits that there is something wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, but it's through the three points of art, you know, canvas, heat, and designing shirts, and me building, you know, an arc, so to speak, in my driveway, and her with a painting.
I'm glad you brought that up, because another thing that it deals with are the healing powers of the creative arts.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Absolutely.
Not to mention that in terms of suffering, I mean, the occupational hazards that if you look, you point out a great artist, past or present, then tell me that, show me one that wasn't suffering from some form of pain, from Hemingway to Van Gogh to you know, Brando. Pick somebody that's brilliant. Look at the Renaissance. I mean, 1,000 years of creativity, and then, you know, you got Switzerland, where it was 500 years of peace, and all they produced was a cuckoo clock.
Ah, the third man.
That's right. Orson Welles, and yeah, Orson Welles, there you go, another guy.
Yeah.
So the occupational hazards of, you know, when you go into acting school, they tell you to be childlike, to embrace that quality, to be inventive, to have vivid imagination, you know, to nourish your imagination.
Yeah.
And my imagination gets me in trouble. I mean, doing this movie was simply selfish on my part. I wanted to get as far away from the Ralph Cifaretto character as possible. And then, going through the journey of it, you know, I saw more of my mother and Marcia's character.
Yeah.
And it wasn't until I screened it at Penn State at my daughter's school. And, you know, Joe will tell you, we've gone to a lot of these screenings. So, you know, I get tired of watching the movie. But at this point, at Penn State 4 months ago, I did watch it again for the first time. And I realized, having seen it more, maybe four or five times, that I was portraying my father in that movie. Because my father would sell us kids, he'd sell us out only to make peace. No matter what it was, he would always surrender to my mother's, crazy episodes, just to calm her down, whatever it would take.
Right.
And that's when I started having to, you know, deal with understanding that my mother's, you know, screaming for her tranquilizers and, you know, punching herself in the face, you know, scratching her face till it bled. I just thought that was normal, that everybody's mom was like that.
Well, you're remarkable in this film. But I think it's safe to say that you're known for some of your more morally questionable characters.
They're fallible. I mean, it's like, it's so easy to say, when people say, "Oh yeah, you were the bad guy in the Matrix." What that guy had to do, what Judas, you know, Judas was Jesus, was one of Jesus's most faithful followers. And then, in selling him out, you know, was destroyed.
Yeah.
He destroyed himself once he did it. You know, he was so flawed. But, you know, when the guy in the Matrix who gets the opportunity to, you know, killing the people that he loved and then having no memory of it and then getting to come back as a movie star, I'd do that to Joe Greco right now.
Are there particular challenges to playing a regular family man?
I don't know. You know, there was nothing regular about this guy because he's, you know, he was on a sinking ship. I mean, the metaphors that Joe created, you know, with building a ship and building an ark and going back to the real Florida. I mean, everybody really wants what Mary verbalizes. Mary says, "I want to go back to the real Florida." Well, that was the Florida that we all remember and love, and all of us really want to go back to the real Florida, but we don't know how to get there. And, you know, what I like about this movie is that there is no magic pill. You know, there is no, romanticism of a dreaded disease that I thought was a minority illness until I got more and more involved in the movie. And, you know, and now we're being embraced by all groups, and kids love this movie. My daughter, my teenage daughter, my college daughter, my 9-year-old, they all love this movie because of these kids that are in it. It's really a love story. I mean, the movie's a love story about a problem that occurs in the family, and nobody gives up on Mary.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and unconditional love, really. I mean, that's
you know, I don't have that in my life, unconditional love. The only ones that love me unconditionally in my household are my four dogs. You know, I got, there's all other kinds of conditions. I come home, they come running out, they're wagging their tail, they really don't want anything.
No, Joey's got a great family, and, you know, when I met Joey for the first time, you know, I hadn't, you know, all I saw were most of the films that you guys are mentioning, you know, the films where he's, you know, playing the amoral character. But when I met him, I immediately felt comfortable and recognized a lot of qualities that my father had, you know, has. You know, my father's a great loving man and an Italian-American father who says more oftentimes by what he doesn't say, if that makes sense. And
yeah.
And that's really why I felt Joey was right for this. And there's and I think in some of the scenes in the film that I love the most, you almost expect Joey's character to whack one of the other characters. You know, there's like this, you know, and that kind of edge I thought was really good for the movie, and that complexity, you know, I thought was really appropriate, you know.
Well, they're always threatened. They're always on the verge of kind of just a breakdown. And
yeah,
you know,
I think
all families, whatever situation they're in, can relate to that.
Yeah, and because there's a scene where Joey's character gets. I mean, I don't want to give away too much here, but basically, the family goes through hell.
Yeah.
And the guy loses his job, and you know, there's a moment where you think that Joey's character is gonna. You know, hit his boss. Like, what the hell are you doing here? But, but all the characters, you know, the kids and Joey, there's a crossroad. There's a point where we could all either act out negatively from something that happens in our lives, or act out positively and sublimate what happens into a positive outlet. And I think that's also what I think the movie's about. You know, Marcia certainly is using art. But also Joe, you know, Joey's character, you know, John, what he's built, he's trying to hold on to his life. And if he didn't have, and I think everyone wants to connect with something or someone. And if they can't connect, you know, John can't connect with his wife, so he's going to connect with this boat. The kid, you know, he's using art, you know, he's putting himself into, or using the artistic outlet to cope.
Yeah, but out of a necessity, I mean,
he
becomes a breadwinner.
He could just as easily turn negative. You know, he could have been, you know, turned to drug. I mean, we've seen that story though, you know, and I, you know, wanted to tell a story where there's positive, there's a positive way to get through it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry, Joey. What were you going to say? Go ahead.
No, that I've learned so much having done this movie, that my life is really, I'm in a much better place today than I was 2 years ago when I started working on this movie. You know, emotionally, I'm grateful for all that I've learned, all that I know, and, you know, it was a very, very hard experience making that movie. I had, you know, all of these wonderful producing partners that had never produced a movie before, but you know, they put their own money out. They begged, borrowed, and steal, and we were able to make this movie, and you know, without killing each other, really.
Well, I know that you talk about how meaningful this journey has been with this film, Mr. Pantoliano. You've started actually a No Kidding Me Too. Society.
Yeah, it's a 501c nonprofit to take on stigma and to destigmatize mental illness and to de-isolation that goes along with when Mary is diagnosed with schizophrenia. The relatives don't want her over the house because they're afraid that she's going to you know, maybe bite the family dog.
Mm.
And you know, I'm co-president of the Creative Coalition with Tony Goldwyn, and we take on it. Matters of the art that are nonpartisan issues, and I think mental illness, well, I know for a fact that that's the most nonpartisan disease I know.
Mm.
So what we want to do is to reach out and raise awareness because it's more common than one would think. I had no idea that 2 in 5 Americans suffer from some form of mental illness, or if anybody's diagnosed, or if a child is born with autism, that illness is going to affect 11 immediate members in the family. You know, 4 in 6 Americans have someone in their life that they know or love that is suffering from some form of mental illness. And, you know, this is a movie that deals with, you know, bipolar disorder, depression, schizophrenia.
It's so much more widespread than anyone realizes.
And what we're finding out is that you know, a lot of folks that are going into rehab with alcohol addiction or drug addiction is really self-medication from what is simply, you know, depression or bipolar disorder.
Right.
Because before I met Joe Greco, I thought that schizophrenia meant that you had multiple personalities, that you saw things, that you heard things, that, you know, it's so sophisticated. And you know, I thought that electroshock therapy was a horrible, torturous way to deal with a person because of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. But in fact, you know, we find out now, Joe and I went to this NAMI convention where they honored us with the Best Picture Award. But Kitty Dukakis was there, and she gets electroshock. Over 100,000 people get it. It's the most benign and most successful form of therapy for depression.
Wow, I did not know that.
Wow.
I had no idea.
Well, Mr. Greco, I know that this project is so personal for you, and you're a Florida State graduate, and you chose to shoot the film in your hometown of Hollywood, Florida, which is right near my neck of the woods, actually. I'm a Florida boy as well.
Where?
I'm in Lakeland, which is between...
Oh, yeah, okay.
Yeah,
I know where that is.
I'm in that little patch of land right there. Was that an important decision for you to shoot in a comfort zone?
Yeah, I mean, I'm so appreciative that the producers and the cast supported me on that decision. I mean, initially, you know, it's my first feature, so I'm so excited to have the opportunity to make the film. And Joey and Marcia, being from New York, I actually entertained the idea of going to New York and shoot it there. And you know, Marcia had just had her twins, and so I knew it would be much easier for her if I shot in Jersey. And as luck would have it, the timing was such that we had to shoot this in October, and the money and the investors and the producers were all pretty adamant that we shoot in Florida because it was actually going to be cheaper. And thank God, you know, everyone agreed, you know, and Marcia and Joey were like, okay, fine. But the funny thing was, Joey said to me, well, you got to shoot in October if we're going to do this. I said, well, Joey, that's it's still hurricane season. I mean, can we do it a little later? No, you got to do it in October. I got other movies going on. You got to do it in October. And so when Joey Pants says you got to shoot in October, you shoot in October.
Yeah.
So, you know, Hollywood, Florida, where I grew up, hadn't been hit by a hurricane in over 40 years. I thought, what the hell?
Oh my.
We actually got hit by Hurricane Katrina, outer bands of Katrina, before it went on to devastate New Orleans. Then we got hit by Rita. And this is all in pre-production prep. You know, we're about 2 months out. And then our third week of shooting, and we're doing this movie on you know, a shoestring to begin with. So our third week of shooting, Hurricane Wilma comes and hits us directly. And on my mother's birthday, ironically.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, it shut us down for 4 days. We almost didn't finish the film. And Marcia and Joey and the little boy, we sent them out of town because we didn't want them to be in Florida when the thing hit.
Yeah.
And they came back knowing full well that the hotel had nothing but candlelight and no air conditioning. And they had to fly into Orlando, which is 4 hours outside of Hollywood, and drive down because the airports were closed.
We couldn't get in our rooms because electricity was out. You know, the electric stick on your card.
Yeah.
Like, you know, your valuables are in that little safe, that electronic safe, so you can't get any of that out. You know, and Devin was selling lemonade to help pay for the food for the cast and crew.
I don't know if it was that bad, but it was close.
Well, that's Florida for you. And probably, I would think, if you picked up anything from working as an assistant to James Cameron during Titanic, it taught you that you can overcome those stumbles.
Yeah, well, you know what?
Well,
James
Cameron had $250 million to overcome it.
That's true.
Yeah, well, you know, but it's funny you should say that, because I kept thinking that to myself. It's not as bad as Titanic. And it was...
Yeah, at least Titanic had a band.
Yeah, but you know, I gotta tell you, I mean, looking back, it was hell. But I had an amazing cast. The crew was unbelievable, and the producers, everybody, just it was a labor of love. And you know, and I think you know, they were able to have get gas, they were able to have a hot meal when they couldn't, you know, at home. So it was, you know, we were this little oasis where people could come and actually continue working when most of the city was just devastated.
Yeah,
and
the movie is made out of love, and you just you absolutely feel that, and I think that's what's affecting audiences, and you know, films like these are sadly more and more rare in today's theatrical climate. So everyone just owes it to themselves to go see this film. It's amazing. Before I let you guys go, I have to ask you, Mr. Pantoliano. You know, you've got over 120 amazing credits to your name, and you've worked with Spielberg and De Niro and all these classic films. But I'm willing to bet that when the average person approaches you on the street nowadays, it's got to be all about Frankie Cefarelli and The Sopranos. Am I right?
No. Well, it depends. You know, I'm shooting a movie right now in Spokane, and it's been more Bad Boys than The Matrix.
I see that.
You know,
yeah.
I was shooting up. I was working just recently in New Mexico, and there's a lot of colleges there, so it was more Memento. You know, like
yeah,
questions
yeah.
on Memento. And as far as Rob Cifaretto, I get that a lot in like the New England tri-state area.
Okay, that was such a dynamic series, but that the conclusion of that series was perfect, right? I mean,
I thought it was awesome.
Yeah. It was one of those conclusions where at first I didn't quite get it, and I've heard this from so many other people, but. And when you reflect on it, it makes more and more sense to you. And it was just a perfect way to end that show. Just a wonderful show.
Yeah, and I think that David, you know, the idea that there was that bleep of darkness where everybody thought, "What the fuck, my television?" You know, I don't think I can say the F word. Can I?
You can say whatever you'd like.
Say whatever you like.
So you automatically remember where you were, right? You're gonna always remember where you were, but I think it's all there. And at the end of the day, it's like Tony is going to have to, and that family
yeah.
will be looking over their shoulder, and it might be for the next 30 seconds, or it might be for the next 30 years. But it's
right.
What a way to live a life.
It was perfect. Yeah. Yeah. So the film opens in major cities on the 12th of October, is that correct?
Yeah.
And then the following week is Los Angeles.
The 19th. So the 12th, New York, Chicago, and then the 19th, it opens in other cities. So.
And what cities are those, Joe? It's Los Angeles, Arizona.
Let's see,
Phoenix,
New York, Chicago, Los Angeles, Phoenix, Fort Lauderdale, and there's a few others, I think, that are
Michigan,
Whittier, Connecticut, Portland, I think Grand Rapids.
That's right, Wilton Theater. Yeah, Wilton, the Bowtie Theater in Wilton, Connecticut, where I will be doing Q&As all weekend long.
Oh, wow. And is that on the 19th or the 12th?
That's the weekend of the 12th.
Oh, excellent. Well, I urge everyone to go out and see.
Oh, one more thing, if you wouldn't mind. Please ask your listeners to go to canvasthefilm.com.
Yes.
And they can put their email address and get alerts. So as the movie builds an audience, we'll be going to other theaters, and we'll be letting them know that.
Okay.
Cool.
Absolutely.
All right.
We have links for those sites on our pages as well. So, gentlemen, thank you so much for being with us tonight. It's been an honor to speak to both of you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I really appreciate it.
Best of luck on the film.
Thanks, guys. Thanks again.
We appreciate
Dave.
It. Great show, and we'll talk soon. Take care.
Thank you so much, Mr.
Thank
Grant.
You.
Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye.
That is, I guess I can say it now, that's Joey Pants.
Yeah, it is.
And
yeah,
Joseph Greco.
We did it.
With Canvas, an absolutely wonderful movie, and everyone, go see that movie, because it's the kind of movie that people have really taken into their hearts in a way that I've never witnessed before, and you owe it to yourself to see that one. It's a great film. All right, we just spoke to Joey Pants, and...
I know, it's slowly sinking in.
I got to tell you, you know, I'm sure you could hear it in my voice when we first started. I was very nervous about the show and the prospect of speaking with Mr. Pantoliano, because he's such a, I mean, we all love and admire and respect his work so much. It's meant a lot to us over the course of our lives, but I had to give him a reminder call prior to the show to remind him that in 20 minutes the show starts, if you could call in. And I was very nervous. So I call, and he answers the phone, and he says, "Yeah!" It's like really loud. And I said, "Mr. Pantoliano, I'm Jamie from Movie Geeks United. Can you call us in 20 minutes?" And it was just nerve-wracking. But what a wonderful artist and the wonderful man to be on our show on his birthday, no less.
It's, yeah, that's incredible right there.
A great treat to speak with him tonight. All righty. I think we have a caller. Let me take this caller first.
Okay.
817 area code. I think I know who this is. 817, go right ahead.
Mystery guest sign in. Hey, it's John from Dead Air Show.
Hey, what's up?
Hey, John. How you doing? That's
great. Jamie, that was a fantastic interview. You did very good.
Thank you, man. So. Thank you.
It's funny. One of my earliest memories of watching a movie and feeling terrified was seeing The Goonies. And
that's right.
There's the scene at the opening when the Fratellis escape from jail.
Yeah.
And Joe rolls down the window and shoots the gas that Robert Davi lays out, shooting up flames, a big circle of flames around the cops. And as he rolls the window up, he's cackling this maniacal laugh, and you see, like, the reflection of the fire in his glasses.
Right.
And I just remember, I mean, that scene sticks out of my head, even though, of course, I've seen the movie a million times since then.
Those are, they're burned in your memory as a child.
Yeah,
and he's so underrated, you know?
Yeah, he's absolutely one of our greatest actors, and because you cannot forget him in anything he's in. He's
that's
always
exactly true.
A standout. But thank you so much, man, for calling in.
Oh, not a problem.
And listening, most of all. Thank you so
yeah,
much. And
we'll
talk to you soon, buddy.
All right, guys.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
All right. Exciting. You guys ready for another exciting segment right now?
Yes.
Our next guest is on the line and up and ready to go. Remember when horror movies were fun? Writer-director Adam Green does. In his new deliriously effective film, Hatchet, Green pays cinematic ode to those classic slasher flicks from the 80s. But in a strange twist, he skillfully infuses his film with genuinely witty dialogue, smashing production values, and believable and sympathetic performances. The pictures receive the type of mainstream critical praise usually reserved for only the most astute art house pictures. This follows an extremely successful premiere at the Tribeca Film Festival that set the industry buzzing, and last week's limited release that's been packing houses with tens of thousands of pleasure-starved horror fans. This film is a real treat for anyone looking for a genuinely scary film that still has time to delve into the trashy, guilty pleasures of this long-abused horror subgenre of the slasher film. It is a great pleasure to welcome the writer and director of Hatchet, Mr. Adam Green. Mr. Green, are you there? Mr. Green, are you with us? I saw his line there, and he is gone.
Oh, no.
Maybe, hang on real quick. I think you might still be on there. Mr. Green, are you there? It says that he is on the line. We'll keep checking that. But Hatchet, have you heard of this film?
I've heard about it. I've been reading about it for like the last year, well, even longer than that. But I have not had a chance. It hasn't opened up close to us yet, where I've gotten a chance to go see it, but I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, it's an incredible film, and it, you know, these types of movies, you're so used to being let down by them, and
true,
disappointed by them. But this movie is just an incredible ride, and it's a lot of fun. And when was the last time you saw a horror film that you had fun in? I mean, it used to be the norm, but now they're getting more and more dark and grim. And Hatchet is just a tremendous escape from that.
You feel that like Hatchet is definitely like a throwback to the 80s slasher film.
I think it was absolutely designed that way. And now I think he's back on the line. We can ask him personally about
okay,
it.
Okay, good.
Mr. Green, are you with us?
I think I'm with you. Can you hear me?
You are here. Hi.
Right,
how
excellent.
Are you?
I'm doing good. I was saying before, I wish you could have just kept going with what you're saying about the movie. That was awesome. I'm like, I could listen to this all night. This is great.
Well, I had a great time watching your movie, man. It's fantastic. And I'm really interested to know what your initial inspirations were when you sat down to write it.
Well, you know, I grew up in the 80s, and all of my influences come from the 80s, and that's the type of stuff that made me fall in love with this to begin with. By the end of the 80s, it had sort of beaten itself up, and it had just gotten, like, extremely ridiculous.
Yeah.
And couldn't stand it anymore. And then in the 90s, we had Scream, which was awesome because it was finally a good script in a slasher movie, and they had never really done that before. But it was also sort of this teen whodunit thing where at the end of the day, like, they'd pull the mask off and it was, you know, oh, and it was you all along. And, you know, I wanted to see a monster. I wanted to see some gore and some tits. And that was
You didn't want
on.
To see a Scooby-Doo mystery.
No, I didn't. And then that sort of gave birth to PG-13, which was the worst thing that ever could have happened.
Yeah,
you're right. I'm not going to argue with you there.
Yeah.
Yeah, and, you know, it's not that I don't think a PG-13 movie can be scary, but a PG-13 slasher film, no. That's like a porn without the money shots. Like when you're at the hotel and you rent the porn.
I love this guy.
And all of a sudden they keep cutting away and they don't show it when you know, you're like, what did I just pay for?
Exactly. This man is the right, you have the right ideology.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, what are some of your favorite films from the slasher genre?
Let's see, you know, all the Halloweens, the Friday the 13th, the Nightmare on Elm Street. But my biggest influence with Hatchet was actually An American Werewolf in London.
Mm, good choice.
Because that movie was like Landis at his peak, where he took a gory, like, violent horror movie and he made it so entertaining that anybody could watch it, even if you didn't normally like to see blood and guts.
Right.
And then, of course, there's that whole dream sequence with, like, the Nazi zombies. That's just...
Yeah, Nazi werewolves.
Yeah, I have no idea what that's doing in this movie whatsoever. And I don't think he does, and that's why it's so great. And so that was really my biggest influence. When I was writing this, I kept sort of thinking about that. And even when you see the whole beginning of Hatchet, it's like two tourists that are out of place. They're looking for something to do. They're, you know, people are giving them advice. They're not listening. It's even the camera shots. It's very American Werewolf. And very few people get that. Everybody always goes to the Friday the 13th thing,
yeah.
I think, simply because Kane Hodder is Victor Crowley.
Right,
you think about it, tonally, Friday the 13th movies were nothing like this. They took themselves very seriously. Now they're funny, but at the time they didn't realize how funny they were, I don't think.
Well, it's extremely rare for a film of this genre nowadays to be like Hatchet, because you still maintain what I refer to as those kind of trashy pleasures of those films, but you have an incredibly good script that you've crafted, and you pull like outstanding performances from your actors, and that's just so rare. Is that definitely something that you focused on when you mounted this production?
It was so important because if we hadn't had that, it would be just another slasher movie, and honestly, who needs one right now?
Mm-hmm.
Like, this stuff had its heyday, and it's where it belongs, and it's not like I'm trying to bring it back. I was more just trying to make the movie that I had always wanted to see, and it was like, what if you had that formula, but you actually put real actors in there, and you actually spent time on the script, and most of our time on set wasn't really spent on the action or the effects, because we had done our homework with that. We knew exactly how we were going to shoot it, and it all went pretty flawlessly. But it was working with the actors and giving them the time to get the timing right and to get to know each other and treat it like it wasn't a horror movie. And sometimes we'd almost forget. It was like we were making a comedy.
Yeah.
And that's really the spirit of the film, and I think that's what... You know, and you get a mixed bag, with the horror crowd, because some of them don't want comedy in their horror movies.
Mm-hmm.
And they went to see it, and they're like, I just want to see the most, like, messed up, crazy stuff that I could possibly see. And we have that in there. We definitely outdo the violence of any of the other movies that are out right now. But it's got its heart in the right place, and it's not sadistic. It's fun, and you're laughing. And when you see it with a full crowd, they all start clapping and cheering, and that was the experience I wanted to bring back, because it's gotten to the point where
you don't even need to see some of these movies in the theater anymore because you sit there in silence, you're disgusted, you're horrified, and you go home and you throw up.
Yeah.
And that's not why we got into this. We're not sick people. If we were sick people, we'd stay home and watch autopsy videos or, like, jerk off the Holocaust videos or something. Like, we watch this stuff because it's a good time and it's a communal experience.
Right.
And I think that that's what this is bringing back.
Great analogy, too. That's, he's right.
The whole Holocaust thing. It's...
No, but he's got this. That's just brilliant.
Yeah, and I think that's the major thing that people should understand about this film. It is fun. And it's interesting how you bring up the comedic and the horror aspects that you've kind of melded into Hatchet, because I would think that those would be two competing emotions, two competing releases.
They are, and yeah. it was very all of us, everybody on the set was always very careful about, if you're going to do this, you have to keep the comedy out of the horror, because if Victor Crowley becomes funny, then there's no point watching the movie anymore, and
yeah.
You've lost the audience. So every time the shit hits the fan, it's scary. And then it was more just putting funny characters through the situation. And the other thing that comedy really brought to this is it made the characters likable, because in a slasher movie, you don't just want a body count. You want actual characters, and if you can win the audience over by making them laugh, you're just going to get them into your characters much faster. So everybody in the movie is basically a comedian that I hired. But they also deliver the goods. I mean, when they're scared and they're crying, and they're awesome.
They absolutely are. And it is genuinely funny and genuinely frightening. And it works so well on both of those levels. But in Victor Crowley, you have definitely created one of the great lead villains in the history of horror movies. Tell me a little bit about him.
Well, I got sent to summer camp when I was about 8 years old, and it was the worst experience ever, because it was like a concentration camp where it was like all you did was floors and clean toilets, and it was called Camp Avoda. And I found out when I first started doing the festival tour, I was telling the story, somebody in the audience raised their hand, and they're like, you know that Avoda is Hebrew for work. I'm like, oh, my parents sent me to camp work. No wonder it sucks. And the camp was awful, and the counselors were just kind of dicks, and they said, just stay away from this one cabin, because if you go near here, Hatchet Face is going to get you. And I had an older brother who had shown me all these slasher films, so I was all excited. I'm like, Hatchet Face? Why is he Hatchet Face? And they just said, because he's Hatchet Face. I said, well, what's he going to do to me? And they said, he'll get you. I'm like, with what? Like a glove full of knives, a machete, what's he going to get me with? And they didn't have any answers. And I'm sure at some point, in the beginning of the camp, they had a real story, but they just sort of drank it away over the years and they forgot it.
Yeah.
And so that night, as all the kids were going to sleep, they were like, you think Hatchet Face is going to get us? And I just busted out the whole story of Victor Crowley right there at 8 years old. I'm like, he was a deformed man, and he was left hidden in that cabin, and the door caught fire, and his dad came home with a hatchet, and he hit him in the face, and all the kids started crying. And the counselors called my parents, and they were going to send me home from camp, and I was like the weird kid at camp for the rest of the summer. And which was fine, because like I was there cleaning toilets. I thought I was going to touch boobs and stuff. Like, I'd see these movies about summer camp. I'm like, this is going to rock. There was no boobs. It was just sports and cleaning toilets. It sucked.
So this has been in your mind since you were a child. Was this a difficult project to get off the ground?
It was, I want to say it was almost impossible, but there's so many people out there with projects that still can't get off the ground, so I feel badly saying that. But when I first wrote it, now I come from a comedy background. The first like independent movie I made was a comedy. Disney wound up buying it. That was sort of how I got into Hollywood. They turned it into a TV series that Tom Shadyac produced and I wrote, but it was for UPN, which ended up folding, so it never actually made it to air, which happens every day out here. Like, you start telling people, oh, I got this movie, I got this show, and then next day, like, yeah, it's gone.
Yeah.
And I wrote Hatchet while I was waiting to get notes back on that, and my agent was like, I don't get it. I'm like, what do you mean? He's like, well, it's so violent, but it's kind of funny. I'm like, no, it is funny, and the violence is kind of funny, too, and he just didn't get it. So he sent it to just a couple places at the big studios, and one of the first rejections I got said, the writing is brilliant, but this type of movie will never get made because it's not a remake, it's not a sequel, and it's not based on a Japanese one. And that was like a
serious... That's a flop.
Yeah.
Oh, right. And if you guys have ever seen the poster that we hung up for the festival tour, that was the tagline. It said, it's not a remake, it's not a sequel, and it's not based on a Japanese one.
Mm-hmm.
And the fans love that. And other people who'd be standing in the lobby in the theaters just didn't get it. They're like, what does that even mean? And that's really the spirit of the movie. It's only for certain people. So nobody in Hollywood got it. And I went and I raised money by basically what we did is we made a mock trailer, which you might have seen online at some point, but it was basically just a little girl telling the story of Victor Crowley, and all it showed was a swamp, and we had a few flashes of things. And actually, the final trailer for the film is based on that mock trailer.
Yeah.
And by having that mock trailer with a fake date on it, it said, like, coming to theaters Halloween 2005. Like, that's how long ago we started. This was 2003. And we went to the investors and private equity people and producers we had met and all these people who said they knew people with money. And not only did, you know, once they said, okay, we like the script, then you showed them that, and it sort of really whet their appetite, and it was like, you know, your name here type thing.
Right.
And that really got them excited. And then one of our producers, Sarah Elbert, had just produced the Friday the 13th box set. So she already knew John Buechler, and he read it, and he was on board, and then Kane was on board. And then that mock trailer got leaked onto the Internet. And all the horror websites started posting it and saying, okay, there's this movie Hatchet, and it's coming out in 2005, and we didn't even have the money yet. And so it helped when we could say to the investors, okay, tonight when you go home, Google Hatchet and just see what comes up. And they saw just all these kids like, oh, my God, I got to see this movie, I got to see this movie. And it was like a no-brainer to invest in it because it's not a lot of money to make it. And they know even if it sucked, they were going to make money on DVD. So it was like, okay, fine, let's do it. And we were off and running, but unfortunately, we had to shoot it in the summertime, and the whole movie takes place at night. And it sucks because the sun goes down at 9, and it comes up at 5 in the morning. Typically, you get 12 hours a night or a day to shoot, and you can go 16 hours if you can afford the overtime. We had 6.5 or 7 hours. That was it. So a 24-day schedule, it was more like we shot the movie in like 12 or 14 days. And when you're lighting people on fire and you have live alligators and underwater photography and people on boats and rain towers and stunts and blood geysers and effects and children, and it was the worst possible movie to try to shoot in those conditions. But I hired my crew based on their personalities and not their credits. Like, people would come in to interview. I'm like, okay, what's your favorite horror movie? Some of them would say, I don't really watch them. I'd be like, okay, fuck you. And then who's next? And it's like, Evil Dead 2, like, you're hired, you get it, you're on.
Right, right.
And that was how we did it. And this just the spirit of everyone, every time something would go right, the whole, like, all through the woods, you would just hear people cheering and screaming, and it was just a bunch of horror fans making this movie. And
Is that palpable? We were speaking with Christina Klebe earlier in the week, and she's one of the co-stars of the new Halloween, and I was interested in knowing whether or not you can sense that something is frightening as you're shooting it. Is it a palpable feeling that you get?
Yeah. For me, I've already seen it in my head, and I'm waiting to see it go by in the monitor, and I know when I got it. But there's also a feeling that goes through everybody. There were a couple times on this when even, like, my assistant director would sort of pull me over, and he's like, you know, I think this has gone far enough. Like, because Tamara Feldman, who's the lead, is the most giving, like, just generous actress, and she just gives herself completely. And she had slipped and told me some of her phobias before we started shooting, and one of which was fear of the dark. And so there's a scene in the movie when she has to discover her brother and her father dead in Victor Crowley's shed.
Yeah.
And she never worked with those two actors, and so what I did is, while they were on set, I took all these candid pictures of Robert Englund and Josh Leonard, like, toweling around and doing stuff. And then right before we were going to shoot the scene, I took her aside. I started showing her these Polaroids. And I'm like, this is when you went to your aunt's house for Christmas. This is where you and your brother used to go. And she just, like, started melting.
Mm.
And then I walked her into the shed with just a little pen flashlight. And I said, okay, wait right here, and I'll be right back. And I took the flashlight and left. And she was left there in the dark. And I told everyone on the crew to be silent for 20 minutes. Nobody was allowed to talk. So everyone's just standing there, and all you can hear from the shed is her starting to, like, whimper. Then she's starting to cry, and then she's screaming, somebody come get me. I don't want to do this anymore. I don't want to do this anymore. Please, somebody come get me. And she's hysterical. And then I'm like, okay, camera, and they started rolling. We put on the lights, and she saw them dead and just lost it. And I don't know if you remember this, but in the scene, we hold on it for way too long. She starts crying, and it's like, you should cut, and it just doesn't, and she keeps crying and crying and crying, and then we go to another joke. And when the scene was done, she came out, she punched me in the face, and then she started hugging me, and she was like, thank you for that. That was so awesome.
Those are the kind of cathartic moments that actors are really looking for.
They are, and that's what she said afterwards. The other actor's like, are you okay? She's like, are you kidding? She's like, that felt so real, and it was so genuine, and all of them were willing to do that. They were so willing to go there. And then Kane, of course, just brings fear to a whole other level because he never shuts it off, and he doesn't ever break character. It doesn't matter if it's like a week after we're shooting, they're still scared of him. Even at like the conventions and stuff, he shows up, they don't go near him. They're still not convinced that he's not crazy. So
talk about this cast, because for horror fans in particular, this is a dream cast of all of their idols, basically.
Mm-hmm.
You've mentioned Robert Englund and Kane Hodder and Joshua Leonard from Blair Witch Project and
Tony Todd. Yeah, it sort of just kept happening. John Buechler was shooting a movie with Tony Todd. And I went to his set to ask him a question about my budget because he was really helpful because I'd never done this before. And I'm like, you know, do I need more money for this and how do I do that? And he said, you know, I could really use an extra right now. Would you mind just playing a dead security guard by Tony Todd's feet? I was like, I was going to do that anyway. And just went and like lie down by Tony's feet with like a bullet hole in my head. And we just started talking. And then it helped when I called his agent and I said, my name's Adam Green, I have no money and I'm nobody, just please give me 5 minutes and don't hang up on me. And the agent said, okay, you got 5 minutes, go. And I told him my whole story. I'm like, my dad's a gym teacher, I come from nothing, I have no money and I totally suck, and but I'm making this movie and it's going to be the best movie ever, and like, it has to be Tony Todd, it can't be anybody else. The casting director keeps pushing other people on me, but it has to be Tony. I know we can't afford him, but it has to be him because in the sequel it's a big part and you don't understand. And he listened, and when I was done, he said, you know, sometimes in this business you forget why you got into it in the first place.
Yeah.
And things like this, the fact that you love my client this much, he's like, I'll read it. And he read it, he liked it, he gave it to Tony, he liked it, and he was on board. And the same thing basically with Robert Englund. His is a little different because he met me at a party, and all these kids were going up to him, and they were all handing him business cards and, you know, pitching them stuff and just annoying the hell out of him. And, like, he can't go anywhere. It's rough. It ain't easy being Freddy. And he came up to me because he liked my T-shirt that I was wearing. He wanted to know where to get it. It was a Marilyn Manson shirt. And I told him, you know, I don't know where you get it. You had to get it at the show. And I found it online. I bought it for him, and I sent it to his agent as a gift. And that sort of helped them move my script up into the actual pile next to his bed. And then he read it and just loved it. And he was like, this is the genre that I helped build. He's like, of course I want to put my stamp of approval on this.
It's amazing. You never know what will get you these talents, or, you know, what circumstances will converge to, you know, it's serendipity. I mean, to get Robert Englund, apparently it took the shirt on your back. But
I literally did, yeah.
So your film opened in what, about 80 or so theaters last weekend, or locations?
It opened in 80 theaters, and another sort of, the part of the story that nobody ever really talks about, everyone's always concerned about shooting and stuff, but there was over a year between when we shot the movie and when we premiered it at Tribeca, because that took a while to actually finish the movie, and we wanted to wait for the right film festival to really start this as a serious movie. And when Tribeca accepted us, it was just, oh, my God, this is going to be great. And the New York Times and L.A. Times and Variety, they're like one of the biggest hits of the festival. Everyone's talking about Hatchet. Everybody's talking about Hatchet. And we show up to the opening night, and it's sold out, and the crowd's going crazy, and it's awesome. And we got no offers. Like, all the distributors, some of them walked out on it. Other ones, it was like these pity offers of, like, straight-to-video, like, I mean, just insulting.
Yeah.
And everybody goes to the after party, and of course the cast and crew, they don't know this yet. I'm the only one who knows. And everybody's at this party. I'm literally on the floor of my hotel room crying, saying to my girlfriend, how am I going to tell everybody I let them down? Because it was over. And then I, like, picked myself back up, and the next morning I went to the meeting with the lawyer, and he said, okay, these are the offers that I think you should consider, and we're going to make a lot of money if we go to video. And I stood up and I said, no, refuse all of them. We're going to go. We're going to keep going. And we just kept screening it, and it would sell out, and all the reviews and the buzz online. And still the distributors were not taking it seriously because it wasn't a torture movie. It wasn't a remake. It's just not what they're doing right now. So finally, I rented the Arclight in Hollywood, which is like the nicest theater in L.A.
It is.
It is my favorite theater, yeah.
And it cost me $4,000. And at this point, I hadn't been paid in 2 years. I'm in debt up to my ears. I took out another credit card, and I rented out the Arclight, and I just put something on the Hatchet website that said, tonight at 8, free screening of Hatchet. And it was a 400-seat theater. And I'm like, if we can just get, like, 200 kids to show up, it'll look pretty full in here, and maybe some of the distributors will come. And I invited the distributors again. I'm like, you need to come and see this again. You need to see it with an audience. You're making a big mistake here. Read the reviews. Come on. And 735 people showed up with less than 6 hours' notice.
Oh,
and
wow.
It was completely sold out. And then the distributors come late because that's what they do, and they're in their suits and their Blackberries, and they're like, what do you mean I can't get in? Like, sorry, dude, it's sold out. You got to go stand in that line with 300 kids and wait. And they did. They stood on the sidewalk, and they waited, and then I think it was about 2:30 in the morning that night we got our first theatrical offer, and then it started going from there. So it was... such a battle.
But it's that faith and perseverance that made that happen. And it's an amazing movie.
People know that. And, we just premiered at the Arclight. We had our opening night there on Friday. And it was sold out. And I got up and I told the story. And I said, I promised on the website when if the movie made it to theaters on opening night, I would get on my knees and kiss the floor of the theater. And I put down the mic and I got on my knees and I kissed the floor of the theater. And the whole place gave me a standing ovation. And it was like, that's what it's about. So we're on 80 screens now. So we have no marketing. We have no advertising. There's no TV commercials. There's no billboards. It's so discouraging because we keep getting emails from kids like, oh, I want to see the movie. And it's playing in their town. I just don't know it.
Right.
And in some markets, we're killing. Like in L.A. at the Arclight, last weekend alone, our per screen average at the Arclight was $14,500.
Wow.
One screen. And in Baltimore, we sold out. In New York, we sold out. In Austin, they brought news cameras there because the lines were so long. And then in the Midwest, crickets. There's nobody there. And that dragged down our per screen average. So it wasn't good enough to blow out wide right away, but we have this weekend coming up, and if the people will just get the word out and go. I mean, there's kids who've already gone 4 or 5 times. There's 3 kids who got Victor Crowley tattoos this week. Like, it's really working. It's catching on, and the fans love it. But they got to know that it's there. And if this does well in theaters, it could change everything for horror because Hollywood will not be able to deny that there is an audience for this. And they'll have to start making original movies again.
Well, I know all of our listeners are very interested in Hatchet, and many of them have seen it. They've relayed to us how much they enjoyed it.
They're raving about it.
Absolutely.
That's awesome.
So definitely I wish you the best of luck with it. Everyone, just go out to the theater and see this film. It's a great... great time. But I wanted to leave you with one last question. It's from one of our loyal listeners. His name is Anthony Thurber. He wanted to know if there are any distribution deals yet for your next film, Spiral.
Yes. Spiral is also being put out by Stars Anchor Bay. In fact, in most theaters, if you go see Hatchet, the Spiral trailer is playing before it. It should be in theaters in February, I believe, is what they're saying. But there isn't an actual date set for that one yet. And that one is a Hitchcockian psychodrama. It's completely different from Hatchet. I co-directed that with Joel Moore, who was the lead in Hatchet. And it's a completely different side of myself. And then the next one that I'm starting in a few weeks is a romantic comedy. So,
and that one's called Dead West?
That one's called God Only Knows. Dead West is a horror, like hardcore, like Leone meets Romero thing, but that one is probably not going to shoot till later next year at this point because it's just scheduling. I've had so many things put in front of me that I could have done, but I wanted to really campaign for Hatchet and see it all the way through to opening night. I went to every festival. I did every convention. I went all over the world. In Austin on Wednesday, I think that's when I was there, one of the people there was helping me around actually, like, for was trying to hold me up at one point. He's like, you look like you're going to fall down. Like, I hadn't eaten, I hadn't slept. It was like when you see the people campaigning for president and by the end, they look like all haggard and old. I couldn't even recognize myself. I look so old. I'm like all gray now. It's like, it's killing me. But it was worth it.
Well, that's the life of the independent filmmaker, I guess.
It is.
Mr. Green, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
You
are more than welcome to come join us again anytime in the near future.
Thank you so much. Thank you guys for having me.
Thank you for
being
on.
Thank you, sir. Bye-bye now.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
That is Adam Green, the writer-director of Hatchet, and it really has a big online presence.
Enormous online presence.
I mean, it's a small independent movie, as he just specified, but internet has really changed a lot about the way they market film.
Oh,
you know,
totally.
The possibilities. We have links on our website to his websites for Hatchet. And it's a great fun horror film. If you enjoy the genre and you're sick and tired of all the dread and all the grim horror films out there, this one's different. So just check that one out. All right, our last guest is on the line, and you ready to go, Jerry?
Yeah, I'm ready.
All right. It may seem impossible in this age of endless corporate takeovers and more impersonal forms of communication, but there was a time when a saloon keeper could rule as a king in a city like New York, and no king sat on a higher throne than Toots Shore, a self-proclaimed, uneducated bum who wound up playing host to some of the biggest names in entertainment, sports, politics, and yes, the underworld, and he made many millions of dollars in the process. Now, a new documentary film sheds light on both Toots Shore and the sadly extinct world in which he thrived, a world that actually valued personable social interactions away from the bustles of everyday city life. The film is called Toots, and it's written and directed by highly acclaimed documentary filmmaker Christy Jacobson, who just so happens to be Toots Shore's granddaughter. Ms. Jacobson's resume includes remarkable work in HBO's America Undercover series, the PBS reality series Colonial House, and her portrait of a Teamsters Union conflict in the film American Standoff, which was nominated for a grand jury prize at the 2002 Sundance Film Festival. We are very honored to welcome to our show Ms. Christy Jacobson. Christy, are you there?
I am here. Thank you so much for having me.
Welcome. Thank you for being with us. It's a pleasure to speak to you. I loved your film. I thought it was just phenomenal. And it really, like the best documentaries, it's a very intimate portrait that you paint on a much wider canvas, and I want to get to those themes a little bit later, but this is the story of your grandfather, essentially. But what recollections do you have of your grandfather from childhood?
Well, the truth is that I don't have many recollections of him. He died when I was six, and he was sick before he died, so certainly the man that I knew was not anything close to the man that I later have come to know through making the film. But I do have this sort of one memory of him holding me, looking into my eyes, and he called me Krusty, which I think was a derivative of the nickname Crumb Bum that he called most people, lovingly.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, how did it come about that you set out to make a film about his life?
Well, you know, I'd been working in documentary film sort of ever since I got out of college, and I knew I had this grandfather who had this restaurant, but I didn't know that much about him, frankly. And one of the things that sort of jump-started it was when I was working on this film about the Teamsters Union. I spent a lot of years working with a terrific filmmaker and mentor, Barbara Koppel, and we got together working on this film, and I spent a lot of time on the road and at picket lines with these truck drivers. And, I don't know, oftentimes just in conversation, we would be talking, and I was with someone from Philly, and my grandfather was from Philly, and I'd mention who my grandfather was. And when I'd say the name Toots Shore, these guys who were, like, tough and cursing and yelling at scabs minutes before would just sort of melt. Mm. They just had this real fondness for this guy because they looked up to him, because he sort of, you know, came from the streets of South Philly and rose to great prominence and knew everyone, you know, as you know, from presidents to mob bosses to Jimmy Hoffa to Frank Sinatra. And anyway, their reaction just sort of made me curious. And then I was later working with a producer who was a crossword fanatic and was doing the crossword puzzle and the the clue was restaurateur sure, and I was like, oh, that's my grandfather. And she just totally flipped, you know, like, what? That's your grandfather? She was a lifelong New Yorker and an avid sports fan. And she was like, he's a hero. How could that not be? Why are you not making that film? So then I was like, okay, I really have to start digging. And that was in, oh, God, almost 10 years ago. So I really, I started making the film sort of as my labor of love while I kept working on other films. And would shoot interviews from time to time, and the more I learned about him, the first call I made, I think, was to Walter Cronkite, and a day later he called me back, you know, not
wow.
his assistant. He called me back, and he apologized for not calling me back sooner. So,
wow.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask you about that. So that was your first interview for this project, or so I read, but how nerve-wracking was that to be faced with such a legend right at the start of this project?
Oh, my God. So I'm like, I was like, you know, 20-something. I didn't study film, so I'd never shot anything on film. I'd only shot on tape, and I decided this film is, you know, this is about this era, and I've got to shoot it on film. So it was my first shoot. The first interview was with Walter Cronkite. The second with Frank Gifford, I mean, another legend.
Wow.
And we show up, and like I don't even never even seen a reel of film before, and Walter Cronkite just was, he made me feel like such a pro, like he, you know, I asked a few questions, but he answered them so eloquently, and you know, and he was so warm, as you saw in the film, he sort of wasn't the Walter Cronkite that you're used to seeing.
Mm-hmm.
So, I don't know, it gave me a lot of confidence walking into Frank Gifford's office later that afternoon.
I would think so.
Yeah.
And you interview so many great people in this documentary, but I have to ask you about one, because I saw a previous interview with this gentleman, and he has one of the great lives. He's a tremendous storyteller, and that's Johnny Russo.
Oh, my gosh, a character, a bigger-than-life character, you know, almost like Toots in that way.
What an amazing life that man has had. And he's so entertaining, and I was so happy and pleased to see him featured in your film.
Oh, my gosh. He was, you know, sort of the sleeper star of the film. At almost every screening that I've had where there's an audience, they all want to talk about him.
Mm. Yeah, he's amazing.
Yeah, and he also, I mean, finding Gianni, who's relationship to Toots was completely different than everybody else's. It was, you know, he was a runner. He dropped off envelopes,
right.
Picked them up every day. And he wasn't, you know, Toots wasn't a dear friend of his, so it really helped me in my quest to try and, you know, tell the whole story.
Yeah, yeah. Well, tell me about the mechanics of building this story, of documentary filmmaking. I mean, you make narrative features and you have a script, so you more or less, you know what your outcome
mm-hmm.
is going to be, but do you walk into a documentary with an outline of what you hope to achieve, or just do you let the chips fall where they may?
I think it's sort of a combination. You walk in with, you know, an outline in your head of what you think it's going to be, and 9 times out of 10, or probably 10 times out of 10, that is not what the film is going to be.
Mm.
And in this case, you know, I didn't know a lot about my grandfather, and I was just peeling away the layers, you know, with every interview and every week or month or year, as it turned out, of doing research, I would discover more and more about Toots and his story. But I think the really big breakthrough sort of narratively or in terms of the structure of the film was recognizing that this film was as much about New York City as it was about Toots, and that I had to start peeling those layers away and try and find the balance between telling those two stories, because it you can't understand Toots unless you understand it in the context of what New York was like during that period.
Absolutely, and that's what I appreciate the most about your film, because that comes through loud and clear. And it's just a lifestyle and a society that just does not exist anymore, you know, and I'm not sure about what the many convergence of circumstances that contributed to killing it, that world, but what's your take on that? Why does that world not exist anymore?
Well, I think it was a confluence of things. And I think, first of all, sort of the 40s and 50s in New York was such a unique time in that, you know, what was going on in the world. And, you know, everyone who came to New York during that time, it seems, had a story like Toots's. You know, Toots came from the streets of Philadelphia. Where, you know, Jack Dempsey, I forget where he came from, but Frank Gifford came from Bakersfield, California. All these people came to New York. I think Mike Wallace says it in the film, because they wanted to be, you know, in the Big Apple, and they wanted to make it, and they had to do something to make it. And so they were all sort of, you know, scrapping their way up. Jackie Gleason, Sinatra, all those guys. And so there was this real common bond, I think, that the people of that era shared, that isn't so much true today. You know, the people who we sort of put in the papers and on TV and all the rest haven't necessarily accomplished a great deal by those standards.
Right.
So that's for one. And then I think that also, you know, obviously, I think, or maybe not so obviously, but drinking and just storytelling was sort of the what happened at Toots's and what happened everywhere. You know, everybody told me. And just the other night, we had a screening, and there was a reporter telling me, remember the first time he came to New York, and of course the editor took him to Toots Shores, and he had two martinis for lunch, and he doesn't remember the rest of the day. But that was okay. You know, you weren't like, oh, that guy has a problem. You know, that was just sort of the way it was, and people lived life hard, and they drank hard, they played hard, they worked hard, and you know, there's a lot less of that now. I mean, there's still that, of course, but...
Well, but there seems to be a disconnect now, today.
Yeah, and certainly the wealth, I think, you know, one other major thing that contributes to that disconnect is, you know, as I think it was Maury Allen and Frank Gifford were saying in the film, like, you know, these guys, the writers, were making around the same amount of money as the biggest stars of the time. Joe DiMaggio, Frank Gifford, Whitey Ford, all these guys. And so they were making the same as the writers were. They were making the same as the, you know, the Joe Blow that was working at CBS as a, you know, whatever. And there was this equality that I don't think exists today, and this this huge disconnect with the velvet ropes and the VIP cages and everything. The thing is that the difference isn't, you can't really, it's not like it slowly evolved, it seems. It just seems like it's so extremely different now. And that's what I wanted to accomplish with the film, is to say, look at how different it was. You know, how did we get to here from there? We're always talking about, you know, what we gained in terms of women's rights and civil rights, and I think that that is all obviously very important. But there are some things that I think were lost along the way that are, you know, worth looking at.
Do you think there's a place today for a Toots Shore?
You know, it's funny. Every time I ask someone that question, they would say the only place that is remotely close to Toots Shores is Elaine's.
Yeah.
And I had never been to Elaine's until last night.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That's very true.
Huh?
That's very true. I've heard of Elaine's. You're absolutely
yeah,
right.
And I heard it, and I thought it can't be true. You know, there can't be any place like it. But Elaine had come to see Toots, the film, and she loved it. And I went up there to thank her and have dinner. And I realized, you know, in walked Alec Baldwin. And he just sort of like stopped, said hi to her, and kept going. She was bouncing around from table to table. She was insulting me and others. And I thought, and I felt completely at home, and I'm not, you know, famous or wealthy, and I thought, you know what, and she also did tell me a wonderful story about how when Toots was sort of in his last days, he didn't have the restaurant anymore, and they were at P.J. Clark's late at night, and he said to her, you're the broad that's taken over.
Cool.
And so I guess I have a new answer for that question as of today.
Well, good. I'm glad I caught you today.
Yesterday I would have been like, no, it's not possible.
Well, your grandfather was incredibly successful, and you mentioned that, you know, his place is closed down. And I think like a lot of dreamers, he didn't necessarily have a good business sense, and that that was part of the blame for his downfall, at least in a business sense. But how what do you attribute to his meteoric rise when he was on top? What was it about him that people responded to, mobsters and politicians alike?
I think it was something about his authenticity. He just didn't give a shit, you know.
Yeah.
And it wasn't an act. Like, you sometimes, you know, I've analyzed this a lot, and I've listened to so many people try and figure it out and explain it to me. And I think the truth is that he really said what was on his mind. And as he said in this terrific interview, you know, that we found that when Mike Wallace interviewed him in late 1950s, there he was being interviewed by Mike Wallace, and he just said, if people don't like me, you know, that's their problem. They shouldn't come into my restaurant. And if I don't like them, I don't want them in my restaurant.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, when he was coming up, you know, as a bouncer, he would literally insult, you know, the Bing Crosbys of the world. And I, you know, there's something I don't know, because I don't live in a world where I have yes people all around me. People
right.
are telling me the truth, whether it's ugly or not, all the time. But I imagine that when you're surrounded by that and someone is just really frank with you and tells you, you know what, you played like crap today, you know, it makes you feel real and human. And he was really able to make people feel that way, feel completely at home. And even though he was, you know, maybe making fun of them or knocking them down, he was also, I think, he had an innate ability to build people up when they needed to be built up. And I think those are two qualities that are pretty important in sort of his rise, the way
yeah.
he made people around him feel.
Yeah, yeah. During the course of working on this film, did you recognize any of those qualities in your grandfather, in you? Did you recognize any of that?
Well, I can tell you that last night when I paid for the bill at Elaine's with my producer, and I was like, oh, this is the money that we're supposed to be using to pay for the rights for blah, blah, blah. She's like, you really are just his granddaughter, aren't you? I was like, well, it's in the bank right now. But so, yeah, I mean, I can be generous to a fault, I think. I've got that problem where, you know, I'm at a party and I'm supposed to be, you know, kissing up to somebody, and instead I just don't.
Right.
I think to myself, why can't I do it? Oh, right, it's in my genes.
I have no patience for that either. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean,
some people can do it. Some people are brilliant at it, and that's how they get to the top.
Yeah.
But that's not going to be my path.
I can't do it. I'm just horrible at
yeah,
it.
Yeah, same way. So this was your mother's father.
Yes.
And so what did your mother think of the finished film?
Well, I'll tell you the circumstances of her seeing it. It was the world premiere at the Tribeca Film Festival.
Mm-hmm.
600 people in the theater. No one except for the people on my team, the filmmakers, had seen the film, including her. And she was sitting right behind me, and Frank Gifford was, like, to my right, Walter Cronkite was to my left, and none of them had seen it. And I was really anxious, as you can imagine. But
yeah.
I was most nervous about my mother, because this was her father's story and her father's life. And she loved it, and she's been incredibly supportive and incredibly proud since then. And she says that when she watches it, she... Like, that night she watched it as the incredibly nervous mother of Christy.
Yeah.
And then 2 days later, when she got to watch it again, she saw it as the, you know, that was her father the whole time. So she's had, and then she saw it as an independent film lover later. So she's had more experiences than most in watching it, but she's been a real... a source of support.
Well, it's a real tribute and a testament to the life of your grandfather, and also to a world that, you know, it made me a little whimsical for that time that,
mm-hmm.
you know, I was so far removed from myself when I was
mm-hmm.
brought into the world. But it's an incredible movie. Is this a good time to be a documentary filmmaker?
Wow, that's a really good question. I mean, in many ways, yes, because the fact that this film is going to be released in theaters on Friday, which is very exciting and scary, is, you know, to me, the dream. And I think part of why that's happened is because there's been so many documentaries in the past few years that have
right.
had success
yeah.
financially at the box office. So in that regard, it's great. People are sort of willing. I raised the money for this film independently. I have investors that have believed in me and believed in its potential and believed that it would ultimately get to theaters. And we didn't know that it would, you know, back then when I started making it. So in that regard, in that there's great opportunity to get films into theaters and play them with audiences, which is what you really want when you make a film.
Mm-hmm.
In that regard, it's great. On the other hand, there's you know, the sort of merging of reality television and the documentary form on television, I think, makes it a little bit more difficult. You know, to make nonfiction films for television is, I think, getting a little more difficult.
Yeah, I see that.
Straight up documentaries that are about something and not about a celebrity or that don't have a reality series hook or something.
Right.
Yeah, and some of the most rewarding experiences I've ever had in cinema have been watching these really terrific documentaries where you see real life unfold before your eyes, and it's just so enlightening. And people, you've spoken of this with the reality television, they get the impression that that's what documentary work involves.
Not at all.
Way off base. But you shot this actually on film, you said, correct?
So I shot it on, like, every medium known to man.
Because I was thinking the digital technology would really allow more opportunities for documentary filmmakers as well.
Yeah, I think that's true. Although right now, sort of the changeover to HD is it's also complicated right now. It's like everybody has different cameras and they're slightly different formats, and nobody
right.
knows
well,
about the PT card yet. And so we're sort of in this, like, a little bit sticky transition zone, I think. But certainly, I mean, the access that both, you know, being able to buy a camera and shoot a film pretty affordably is great. And I also think that, you know, I shot much of, you know, going back to when I was shooting Cinema Verite before I made Toots, I shot most things on a smaller format camera, which I think really give you the ability to capture those intimate moments and sort of blend as best as one can into a scene and capture it in all of its honesty.
Yeah.
That helps. But I like you, I love, I mean, obviously I make documentaries, but I love watching them because I love that you get to enter this other world, whether it's someone's culture, whether it's just a person and their life, and it's, you understand things that you never could have otherwise. But I think it's an art form, and it's distinctively different from reality series programming, but oftentimes they're confused.
Yeah, and I
emerged.
Right.
I know that it sounds corny, but I really think that if there was more mass attention paid to some of these great documentary works, whether it's yours or which is an amazing film, Toots is an amazing film, and then one that I saw last night, once again, the Camden 28. It was on PBS. That also was incredibly moving to me. I know it sounds corny, but I really think that people would be, that it would be a better place. The world would be a better place.
Yeah, no, I think
you're right.
Right, James. Mandatory documentary film watching.
Right. I think that's a movement that we should start between the three of us here.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm in.
No one goes to, you know, it's like the theater's empty and it's very depressing.
But people will flock to your film. I know they will. And
thank you. I hope they do.
It opens in New York this weekend?
It opens in New York this Friday, the day after, it's not quite 12 yet. Yeah, so the day after tomorrow, Friday at the Quad and at the Clearview Cinema on 1st Avenue and 62nd Street.
And there's no more perfect, city for this movie to play in.
Right, absolutely.
Yeah, and I mean, we're opening here, and we're ultimately, we are moving out, rolling out, whatever the phrase is, to Philadelphia and Boston on September 28th and Los Angeles in October, and the plan is sort of still evolving. But I, you know, opening in New York is certainly the only way to go with this film, and I really hope that New Yorkers flock to it, as you said.
Absolutely.
I just think, you know, I think it gives people another option at the movies. You know, this is a good old time.
It really is. It's just a remarkable film and a wonderful portrait of a tremendously interesting life and a time that doesn't exist. And it says something about the world we live in today that I think is very important for people to pay attention to. So I very much appreciate you doing our show tonight.
Yes, thank you very much.
And you're more
than
welcome.
Thank you so much. What an honor to be on with you guys and to follow those very tough acts that you started with. I was like, oh my God, these guys are so entertaining. They're great.
No, this is fantastic. I enjoyed it so much. And
I should also mention, my husband actually just walked in and pointed out that I should make sure that I say the website, right?
Yes, absolutely.
Yes, please.
Tootsthemovie.com. We've got all the press and that we've been getting and links to buy tickets to the movies and extra photos and all the rest at tootsthemovie.com if you're interested in learning more.
And I will absolutely make sure that's posted on all of our websites and profiles and blogs as well.
Oh, great. Well, this has been such a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you so
Thank
much.
You.
You're welcome
Good
back anytime you'd like.
Okay. Do I just hang up now?
That's all you do.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Oh, that was a real pleasure. This
that
is
was.
Christy Jacobson, the director of Toots, The Story of Her Grandfather, and really a New York and a world that sadly is lacking today.
Yeah, I would have to say.
Yeah, it's an amazing movie. And all three movies that we've shined a spotlight on tonight are amazing. And crowd pleasers, you know, they're films that just make you appreciate life just a little bit more when you leave the theater. You know, whether it's, you know, just having a great time watching Hatchet, you know, it sounds funny but saying that, but it makes,
I know what you mean. I
yeah.
think most people listening know what you mean, so yeah.
Yeah, I'm gonna get off the air before I start crying. No, I'm kidding. This Sunday, we air at 6 o'clock Eastern Time, and we're building a terrific show. One of our guests, her name is Barbara Duncan, and she actually, it's an interesting story because she read the article we had in the newspaper on Movie Geeks United here
right.
in my hometown. She gave me a call, and she shared her story with me. She's been a longtime personal assistant of James L. Brooks, who we all know is the uber writer, director, producer. He created The Simpsons. He directed and wrote Terms of Endearment and As Good as It Gets. And she was his assistant for 11 years. And
wow.
She went to the Academy Awards with Mr. Brooks during Terms of Endearment. And she's an actress. She's performed in several high-profile films. Just an amazing story. And she left the industry so she could pay attention to her, she could raise her child.
Right.
And so that's a perspective that I'm very interested in getting on Sunday. And we're also working on something else for Sunday that we haven't got 100% confirmation on this, but it'll be really exciting. I'll drop a little hint. It'll be really exciting, especially for fans of the Project Greenlight series that played on HBO for years. I think it's now defunct, but I was a huge fan of Project Greenlight. I never missed it. Did you watch that show?
I watched the first two seasons, and the last season I never got around to watching.
Oh, really?
Really, I never. Once it went to Bravo, I just never got around to it.
I think we got a caller.
Okay.
I think I know who this is. We'll end the show on this.
And it's on a high note.
Yes. Mark, end us on a high note.
I have to say that was probably one of the better shows I've heard as far as radio, as far as television. You guys did an excellent job. I just wanted to call, commend you guys.
Thank you.
God bless you.
Thank you. Your check's in the mail.
Absolutely.
Keep it up, and that's all I really wanted to say. So you guys take care.
God bless
Thank
you, man. Mark is one of my closest friends, and actually – we get together all the time and discuss movies. And Mark, you're going to be joining us for one of these episodes soon, correct?
That is correct. If you guys will have me, I actually was afraid to call in only because you guys had such good rhythm and such good timing with Joey Pants and everybody else. I didn't want to throw you guys off. You guys were on a roll, so once again, congratulations.
Thank you, man. We'll talk to you soon, buddy.
Thank you.
You guys have a good night.
You
bye-bye
too.
Now. That's it for the show tonight, Jerry.
All right.
Fantastic.
Everyone, thank you.
I think we lost Chris like half hour in.
Uh-oh.
He just disappeared. But Chris, thanks you as well. We will be back with you guys Sunday night. See you then, everybody.
All right. Good night, everyone. Thank
bye-bye.
You. Bye-bye.